memorized the title this morning.
So I hope we can stay with it. I suppose there is no one who, at some time or other, has not gone to a friend, a neighbor, or a relative for advice. And civilization has followed this general pattern since the beginning. We have always turned to our fellow creature in time of trouble if we feel that that person is capable of being of practical assistance. And many are. And in the days before the rise of professional psychiatry and psychology, the favorite source of inspiration was the local minister. And if he wasn't quite able to handle some practical problem, there was nearly always someone in the community who had a reputation for solving things. Usually the solutions were simple, direct, and obvious. But they were backed by years of experience. So we may say that in the problem of seeking counsel or help, we must try to find persons capable of providing experience information. Too many people trying to help someone just tell what they feel about it. Or, if I was you, I wouldn't do that. There is no particular background of insight. The individual who is giving the advice has probably never faced that particular type of situation, and if he has, he may have handled it badly. So the problem of trying to help people, as George Bernard Shaw remarked on one occasion, is the most dangerous occupation that we know. We can get into trouble that way, and of course today trouble is not taken as it used to be, as something expected and almost inevitable. Trouble is now the basis of litigation, lawsuits, broken homes, ruptured families, and almost anything you want to think about. So here we are gathered as a group of people trying to improve ourselves. We want to grow. We want to find out a little more about the values of life so that we can live better. In order to do this, we must search in many cases for some outside assistance. Perhaps we will read a book that we feel has a good answer. Or we discuss it with someone whom we regard as authoritative or informed. But always the individual who gives advice has certain responsibilities that he must face. In other words, in order to give advice, it is very definitely necessary to examine our own inner natures. Why do we do this? Is it because we really feel that we are informed? Are we actually able to handle the situation that is brought to us? Or do we try to bluff through on some platitude that has never worked for ourselves? So we have to be careful that we are not trying to play an instructor when we lack the information necessary. It is very important that those who give advice examine their own natures and find out how they themselves have handled difficult situations. Unless they are able to prove conclusively inside of their own minds that they can make a valid contribution to the problem of another person, it is much better to simply decline to pass judgment, because we may be only adding to the prevailing problem. Actually, also, most people like to be suspected of being capable of handling problems for others. We like to feel that we have a certain leadership, that we have a sphere of influence over the lives of those around us. This is really a little more than egotism. It is just a certain sense of self-satisfaction. It has nothing to do with the facts. But if by any chance we are personally ambitious to be recognized as a source of information, that we may often go beyond our natural abilities. We will answer questions that would never meet the requirements of our own experience. Things that never could have happened to us, we will try to pass judgment on or tell someone else how to take care of the situation. This goes on year after year, and nearly every family has in it somewhere an advice giver who nearly always is the one most in need of advice themselves. They may be well-intentioned, good-natured, kindly people, but many of them simply try to advise by imposing their own temperament upon the other person they are trying to help. It's one of the most common introductions to an advice cycle is, "If I were you." Well, this in itself is a dead negative. The other person is not us. Our way of doing things may not have any bearing upon theirs. And may be well to note that these people who have been giving this information have done what they would have done under certain circumstances, and it came out badly. Therefore, this type of advice does not work. If we are in positions where we know that advice is necessary, we can look back on the family patterns of long ago. Hundreds of years back, maybe thousands of years back, the primary source of strength was a family unit in which up to two and sometimes three generations were alive at the same time. These three generations formed a basic experience pattern which they tried to share and pass on to the young. These close family patterns were based upon the common experience of the family unit. The advice given would be applicable to the people for whom it was given. They would be part of the same situation that had caused a father or grandmother to come to certain conclusions about life. So the way in the family unit, it was a more or less self-protecting thing. There were very few religious arguments 500 or 1,000 years ago because most persons belonged to a community of religious life which was suitable to all of them. So in those days, the elders were probably the source of instruction. This was true in the American Indian psychology. The wisdom of the tribe was vested in the olds. The olds were either alive or had gone, but their wisdom lived on. When anything went wrong and there was doubt, the problem was carried to the elders, and the elders in council attempted to assist the solution. The elders were those who had lived long, had been through much, had suffered a great deal, and had gradually integrated an inner life that was secure and proper. This wisdom they could pass on to the young, and the young in those days were very happy to get it. They were quite aware that they were sharing in a continuity of convictions, that as it had always been solved before, so it would be solved again. So the Indians really had a very tight way of approaching this particular problem. They had the medicine priest, and in the Indian philosophy, medicine meant sacred. And all problems were brought to this sort of mystic elder, whose word was law, whose decisions were final, but in all cases were based upon the old wisdom of the people who had gone before, those who had lived long, who had labored hard, and had died bravely in the defense of their tribe. So this type of wisdom became the basis of guiding new generations. Now, the younger generations were not too difficult to guide at that time for one very important reason. They respected the olds. They respected because they saw every day the value of the wisdom that had been accumulated from a lifetime of experience. These young people did not question because in their hearts and minds they knew that the elders were better informed, had the proper solutions to problems. Now, of course, this is very largely broken up. There is no such a pattern anymore in most cases, although among a number of Amerindian groups, the reestablishment of this concept of counseling has been more or less reestablished. It is this close contact with the natural problems of things that helps to make the proper counselor. Now, the Bible, the Old Testament particularly, has to do with the prophets and priestly ones of old. There were those who, out of the wisdom of years or by mystical experiences within themselves, were wonderfully gifted, and even the rulers listened with great attention and were careful not to offend those upon whom the Spirit of the Lord had descended and had given them jurisdiction over the acts of mankind. Now, these old priestly ones were not just simply wise in the professorial sense of the word. They did not speak from an academic background. They spoke from the experience of the ages. They spoke also from a lifetime of constant service to their fellow man. They did not have many ideas of their own. All the ideas that they had been handed down in the scriptures or in the teachings of the fathers. So there was, a kind of descent of infallibles, things that always had worked, things that always did solve, and which the new generation was willing to apply to their own problems. As the family ties broke and the situation scattered, a great deal of this wisdom has been no longer available to the average person. So today, if we have a problem on our hands and we want help, we cannot simply ask somebody. We cannot take it over the fence with the neighbor. We cannot go down the street and to a friend who plays bridge with us on Tuesday evenings. These are not the ways in which we can hope to find solutions. Of course, the first problem, when faced with difficulty, is to look inside yourself. If you can be completely honest with yourself, you are the best counselor you will ever have. But many people are not capable of that degree of impersonality. They are bound to sit on one end of the scales where they weigh a problem. Instead of following the fact of the problem, they follow the implications that they wish to recognize. But if a problem arises, every individual should really say to himself, have I done everything possible to solve this problem? To what degree am I at fault in a critical situation that is developing? It is much better to do this yourself than to pay $1,000 for an analyst to do it for you. And he may come up exactly with the same answer. But the question first of all is, can we solve it ourselves? Can we solve it perhaps with a little encouragement? Someone that we know and believe in can say, I think you can solve it yourself. You have the proper knowledge, you have the courage, you have the strength of character and the integrity to solve your own problem. Now, this isn't giving advice, it is simply pointing up the possible potential of self-analysis. Well, if it happens that the problem could be within a range of self-analysis, then it's very wise to take the position, in my situation, have I been doing what I should have done, or have I been doing what I wanted to do? And if these two are not the same thing, they can explain a great many difficulties. It is always in our way of thinking that we want to be happy, we want to be comfortable, we want to have every privilege possible to us. But the question then arises, how far can we carry this without damaging other people or debilitating our own ethics? Very often, if we think a little while, we can see why things have not gone badly. We begin to understand how a bad investment may have crippled us financially. perhaps only because we tried to get more profit than was reasonable. All the way along, the individual has to curb his own appetites. He has to put a certain restriction upon his own ambitions. He must live within the area of his own available intelligence. And if he does not do this, he is bound ultimately to come to difficulty. Well, you can look through the situation, and if you have a living parent or someone who is very close and has long been very fair in matters, you can perhaps discuss it a little bit with them to see whether they had discovered in you characteristics and traits which you have not recognized that you have. This does not mean that they will give you important or concluding advice, but they may point out how you can help to solve your own difficulty. Actually, we are all in this world to solve problems ourselves. Now, in a complicated civilization such as we live in now, it is not always possible to do this alone. We must call in help. We must do various things that will assist us in protecting our integrities and our normal rights and our responsibilities. Now, if it seems that you do need to have some kind of advice from someone else, then you must begin to estimate the type of person whom you believe can give you the advice that you need. The present tendency is to be a little afraid of professional, technical advice. We feel that too much of this advice is simply given by the hour, it's so much an hour, and that there is really very little basic understanding. Therefore, the psychologist is not always selected as the one to help in these emergencies. And almost anything that a psychologist can do without the practice of psychiatry is to try to help the individual to estimate the nature of his own character. He must realize that he is in his present difficulty because of what he is. He is not in trouble because others have variously injured him. Maybe he is injured in some cases, but it's usually because he has opened himself to the injury. He is not actually looking for an outside cure. He is looking for something that will help him to rationalize his own inner need. So if he goes to an advisor or a helpful person, there are several things to be taken into consideration. Nearly all advice that is necessary for the intimate problems of living is involved in religion, either religion actually or through various phases of religious philosophy or religious practice. Therefore, the tendency may be to consult a religious person. That is often a good thing to do, but there is also something else that has to be definitely considered. We must find someone who we know to be qualified to do the thing we need done. And for the most part, the religious advisor deals in platitudes. He tells you all kinds of abstract things, but he cannot provide the particular, detailed, specific information that will help you out of a difficulty. He also is apt to exercise more than proper authority on you because he is part of your idea of the religious image. To you, he has special authority because of a religious position. And this authority may not in any way include the capacity to help you. Now, the person, on the other hand, who has this authority may be very honest, very willing, and very kind-hearted. But has he ever asked himself whether he is qualified to give advice? I know one case that came to my own attention where a person who really believed that they were inspired by some overpowers, that they had been illumined in some respect, became a sort of counselor to a great number of persons over a period of years, and the result was almost completely tragic. The advice given was not the advice needed. The person giving it did not know what they were doing. But when the problem got difficult, instead of facing the fact that they had failed, they simply moved out of the community and went elsewhere and did the same thing. They left their damage behind them, or simply closed off contact with that which failed to meet their expectations. These people should have settled down quietly and tried to figure out why the advice they gave others did not work. And usually it did not work because the foundation of it was not realistic. The background of the information was not solid. It had to do with strange visions and psychic expressions and manifestations, which no one could prove, but at the same time were passed on as solid facts. These solid facts evaporated, often leaving the victim worse off than before. So if you are going to be an advisor, it is necessary to prepare for the job. Now, parents have to prepare for the job of advising their children, and more it is becoming almost a requisite that the parent is a very skillful thinker on a number of important subjects. The advantage of extra years in which to gain this information is also a deciding factor. But actually, if you hope sometime or would like to believe that you can really help people, that you can get them on their feet when they're in trouble, and if you believe partly in the Christian ministry of preaching to those who need or giving advice to those who are forlorn, then it is necessary to have an adequate foundation on which to work. The individual who gives advice must be well informed in the area in which the advice is needed. Now, it's obvious that no one can be well informed on all subjects. Therefore, there are areas in which advice has to be very general, or else it can become a misrepresentation. Actually, however, behind all of our thinking, there is a simple background which we can all learn and which we can all use in measuring the value of our own advice. Nature is governed by certain rules, by certain laws. The universal purpose to philosophy, religion, and even science is fairly well recognized. What the individual must do to survive is to obey the rules governing survival. The individual who wants to be happy must obey the rules that bring happiness. The same of health, the same of knowledge. Even in sports, unless the person is willing to take the necessary training, he will not excel. So in every basic problem of life, there is a generality in which advice can be passed on almost without particular intelligence. But it is simply advice to keep the rules, to keep the faith, to read the scripture, to follow the commandments of Moses and Jesus. And that if individuals will do these things, most of their problems will evaporate. But our present generation is made up of people who have joined various religious organizations, but have kept all of their previous prejudices. They are not really actually practicing what they preach or what has been preached to them. They have been newborn in some faith, but they do not forgive their enemy quickly. They do not do those things which would protect them against most of the troubles of life. If there is nothing else available to help a person or to give a person basic inspiration, probably the best thing is to suggest that they read the Sermon on the Mount. Because it is simple, it is solid, and it is something that has stood the test of ages, and it is also a high level of integrities from which we have constantly fallen. But these integrities will not fall to help us to survive. We must go back to them. All solution must be according to integrities.
nothing else will actually do any good. If a person has a problem, he must try first to find the source of it in himself. And if he does that, he probably will not have to go much further, because he will find that what is necessary is a new attitude, a new adjustment, a new relationship with the situations that annoy him. So we have this problem now that brings it to a sort of philosophical ground. There is a school of thought that takes it for granted that if we dominate the thinking of another person, we must accept and assume ourselves the consequences of our own advice. Now, this is a very unpleasant concept. And in fact, it's one that no one really wants to follow. We do not want to give advice and learn later that the individual took it and his problems were worse than they'd ever been before. If we do hear this, of course, we have always the traditional evasion that either they did not do what we told them to, or else it was all their own fault, not ours. But where we pass on an influence strong enough to condition another person, where through psychology of dominance, or through some traditional background, or through religious superiority, our influence becomes so definite that it is difficult to resist, and this influence goes bad, we are certainly in some way involved, because I know a number of persons who have ruined other people's lives by their hasty advice, their dogmatic attitudes, their unwillingness to practice the basic principles of Christian charity. So this problem brings into philosophical focus the matter of the responsibility that we have when we over-influence other people. And by over-influenced, we don't necessarily mean a good heart-to-heart talk or something of that kind, but where we put behind that some strange psychic pressure, some mysterious factor, where the person giving advice insists that the advice is not originating with him, but it was given to him directly by the divine hierarchies, this makes it very difficult for the other person to resist what is in fact a delusion. So that where we press an advice, supporting it with factors that are not true, or trying to influence and maintain this influence by exaggeration, or by threats, or by all kinds of misrepresentations, then certainly we are at fault. We are definitely breaking the rules of good living. We are breaking the rules whether we know it or not. Now, many people who suffer do not know that they have broken the rules, but they are still suffering, and sometime they must face the fact that breaking the rules is the cause of suffering. So if a person trying to help another goes beyond the normal state of his common knowledge and attempts to press, force, or over-influence, he is going to take on consequences which may be difficult. A good example of this happened a number of years ago, and a person who came to me, a young woman, when she was in her early 20s, had a romantic affair. The family disapproved, of course, and the mother particularly disapproved because she had already planned that in her older age, the daughter was going to live with her and take care of her. With this in the back of her mind, she fought to destroy the possibility of a marriage. As a result of threats and petitions and hysteria and tears and appeals to family loyalty and divine relationship and honoring the parents and all this, the girl gave up the romance. They lived together, the daughter and the mother, for years. The mother finally died, leaving a 65-year-old daughter who had never been out of her mother's sight. Both lives wrecked. The older woman gone, the younger woman now beyond the age of building a home or having a normal relationship with life. Now, the mother was moved primarily not by the fact that the marriage might have been wrong, She was moved by the fact she wanted to hold the girl to herself. She wanted to be able to dominate this person so that this person would take care of her in her older years. Now, there's a good case for karma. It's almost certain that the older person will sometime have to face this, because it was wrong, it was selfish, it was self-centered, and it was prejudiced. Now, with these factors behind any bit of advice, we may begin to think in terms of karmic difficulties. We begin to realize that where ulterior motive influences the advice, we are already making a serious mistake. The only way in which we can help is when our own affection, our love, our friendship is pure and uncontaminated. If we are trying to do it to improve our own condition, to win the confidence of people we wish to dominate, then we are in bad way. So we can say that karma comes in where there is a misrepresentation as to the importance of knowledge. That karma comes in where an individual is overwhelmed and is no longer able or permitted to think for themselves. This is one point where there's no question that the responsibility is passed on. This person will have to go through a similar experience themselves and will have to face the chances of being themselves exploited at some future time. Whenever there is an ulterior motive, it whiplashes and comes back at us. Another phase of this particular approach to the situation is that we impose upon others the idea that we are like them and that they are like us in many ways where this similarity does not exist. This is the cause of the favorite statement, "If I was you," and then the decision. But never has it been pointed out clearly that I am not you. And for that reason, the whole problem is badly complicated. The woman comes to a neighbor across the fence and says she is going to divorce. And the neighbor says, "Of course you are. You are certainly going to divorce. He's a perfect brute. How did you live with him this long?" The other neighbor, who knows he's a perfect brute, knows it because the wife has told her. She may never have met the husband at all. He might be the perfect brute. You never know. But the neighbor advising, wherever an advice involves a situation that is not obviously constructive, must be taken with a grain of salt. It is perfectly right to say, if you feel that you need to separate, that is your decision. No one should interfere with it. If you want our opinion, we can't give it because we don't know. But somewhere in the great teachings of mankind, there is an answer to your particular problem. And when you get to that answer, you will find that it is constructive, idealistic, and inclined to help the person to grow. Comparative religion helps in this a great deal, because many different religions emphasize different aspects of human relationship. And these different aspects can be applied to the problem of the moment. And sometimes we can't find in the scripture just the answer we're looking for, but we can find it in one of the other sacred books of the world, set in a setting that is just as responsible, just as realistic, and just as honorable. So always we have to understand motives. It is motive in almost every case that determines the consequences of an action. It is the motive that causes us to seek help that becomes a very definite factor in what that help is going to mean and how we're going to use it. It is the motive to be a teacher or a helper or to gain a local reputation for omniscience that makes the individual say things that he shouldn't say. He also may also be influenced by a financial situation in which his financial success depends upon agreeing with aggrieved persons who are willing to pay an exorbitant fee. So all these things have to be kind of sorted out. If we are parents, the law is that we have the right to help these young people, that we have a right to coach them in the things we believe is right. We have a right to chastise them in some way if they break the common rules of life before they're old enough to understand them. We have a right to try and make honest citizens out of our own children. We can do all that is possible. But also, it is very likely that the effort will be clumsy, extremely clumsy. We will simply demand obedience. And we will never question in ourselves whether the thing we wanted them to do was suitable for them to do. We demand obedience and allegiance and unquestioning acceptance. But when the child stands a few feet away and looks back at us, they find that we are not the responsible person who could hold their confidence. So there is rebellion where the conduct of the parents is not consistent with the natural integrities of a child. If these integrities are blighted long enough, they will then be corrupted also, and the trouble will spread, sometimes through several generations. Actually, then, all ulterior motives have karmic consequences. The only thing that has no negative consequence is that which is done with fullness of spirit, kindness of heart, and with all the wisdom, insight, patience, and temperance that we can possibly focus upon the situation. We must in no way try to over-influence. We mustn't fall back upon hypocrisies to strengthen our position. We must not try to plead with a person on some religious grounds which is inconsistent with their believing. All of these side factors have to be faced. Now, advice is something that's not really a mental thing at all. After it's all said and done, advice is an exchange of inner understanding. It is a communication on the level of the human soul. The advice that is given without love, without charity, without honor, is not advice at all. It is rather that we must recognize that as the deity, in one way or another, implants upon the face of nature all the truths that we need to know. And man, over the course of ages, has gradually interpreted many of these truths into words, sacred books, art, music, literature, philosophy, and science. Therefore, the great book of solutions unfolds around us all the time. We have to always try to move only from the deepest side of our own nature. This doesn't mean that we can't think, but it means that the real basis of our understanding is a subtle sympathy by which we find ourselves close to suffering and anxious to serve its solution. Any other motive will get us finally into trouble. Always we must realize that our own experience may not be the necessary thing for another person. We have to try, therefore, to gain as much understanding and insight of experience as possible. My reactions to these things have been largely on the level of comparative religion. I'm a little worried about intellectual philosophies because they do get into trouble themselves quite easily. And the sciences ignore too large a part of the person. But in a mysterious way, comparative religion will show us the good in many faiths and help us to find the answer to the problem that we ourselves face. There's a story in Buddhism about the general of the armies who went to Buddha. And he said, "Master, you teach peace. I am the sworn ruler of the armies of my king. I have sworn that I will defend the state. I will defend the liberties of the people. I will defend the ruler, if necessary, with my life. Now you tell me I shouldn't do, I should be a man of peace. And Buddha said, well, not necessarily. The dedications that you have made voluntarily. And you believe they are right. And you believe they are necessary to protect the state. And you believe, if necessary, that you will fight for the state to try to help it. Because that's all part of your way of life, with one thing you must remember. If that is the way you want to live, you must be prepared to die that way yourself. In other words, if you are a soldier, you must be prepared to face the dangers of that occupation, justified by your belief that it is right. But always, any right that is not peace must be guarded by the fact that the person who tries to fulfill that right shall take the same penalty that might be bestowed upon another by his own action. So all the way along, you'll find little fragments in the teachings of Confucius, in the teachings of Lao Tzu, of Buddha, of Muhammad, of all these teachers. There have been moralists among them, mystics in most of these groups, who have tried to solve the problems of life. And they say, for instance, if you are a badly problemed person, if you have a great deal of difficulties and you don't know what to do about them, perhaps the Coptic monks of the desert or some Zen monastery in the hinterland of Japan has something for you. Take your problem, perhaps, depending on what it is, and simply settle down to the organization of your own inner life. Depend more and more upon the spirit in you and less upon your appetites. Cling closer to your aspirations and do not be over-influenced by your ambitions. Little by little, cleanse the compound of your own nature so that you are not concerned primarily with the gratification of any sensory perception, as Buddha points out. Your real purpose is to learn to get along peacefully with eternity, with the everlasting rightness of things.